Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This morning in the first hour, we'll be talking about the 2008 presidential race, and our guest is Evan Thomas. He is editor-at-large for Newsweek magazine. And we'll be talking about a book that he has put together based on his reporting and also the reporting of some other folks there at Newsweek. The book is titled A Long Time Coming, The Inspiring Combative 2008 Campaign and the Historic Election of Barack Obama. The book is just recently out. It is published by Public Affairs Books. And as I say, it's based on the reporting of a number of people working for Newsweek. What they do a year before the election is they assign reporters to cover the campaigns, and they make this agreement that says, well, whatever they learn, they're going to hold on to until after the polls close. And in return, they get significant access, and they collect stories that don't end up being reported day to day. And what they do is then they put all that together and pull it together to write the story of the campaign. And that's what this book is all about. And that's what we'll be talking about here in this hour of the show. Questions, of course, as always, are welcome. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, whether you're listening over the air around Illinois and Indiana or on the internet across the country, you can use the toll free line. That is 800-222-9455. So locally, 333-9455 and toll free, 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions welcome. We just ask people to try to keep their questions brief so we can keep moving, but you're certainly welcome to call. Mr. Thomas, hello.
Hi, David.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Glad to be with you.
The two men, clearly, John McCain, Barack Obama, are different, have different personalities. Their campaigns certainly had different personalities. If you were going to characterize them in that way, in a few sentences, is there a way to say, you know, here, this was the personality of the McCain campaign, this was the personality of the Obama campaign, and this is how, at some sort of fundamental level, they were different?
Sure. Well, Obama's easy. I mean, because they had a phrase for it, no drama Obama. Has to have been the coolest presidential campaign run since at least John F. Kennedy's. And unusual, because campaigns are a brutal business, and it's a horrible thing to have to run for office for at least 18 months now, and people make mistakes and they have fights. But there was remarkably little of that with Obama, and that was significant because what Obama needed to project more than anything else to the American people was that he could be president. And what they were looking for, I think, and they showed it on Election Day, was somebody who was cool, who could handle crisis, who appeared presidential. McCain, of course, had more experience, so he started off with more of a presumption that he was ready to be president because he's been around a long time and he's a war hero and all that. But he showed... This is a little bit harder to describe, but McCain is basically a subversive. He's kind of a rebel, and that's appealing in many ways. But in some ways, McCain was a subversive in his own campaign. Whenever they just sort of never settled on a clear message and a clear theme. They're always bouncing around. It was as if McCain couldn't agree with his own staff on what he wanted to be, and I think the public sensed that and saw that, particularly in the debate. Mm.
So you're saying is that fundamental difference in the campaigns really goes to the difference in the personality of the two men, and this was a top, the tone was set from the top down.
Yeah, I very much think that campaigns are reflections of the candidates. You can't hide it. I don't care how good your consultants are and how much money you spend on TV and all that modern claptrap of campaigning. In the end of the day, it's the personality and the character of the candidate. And American voters, you know, they don't pay attention for a long time, but eventually they do pay attention. And when they do, they see through all of the imagery and generally see the person that they're voting for.
Yeah. I think that, as you say, if you ask people to pick one word that would describe President Obama, cool would be the one, cool in the sense of calm, unruffled, collected, that sort of sense of cool, although the other sense of cool may apply too. And I think, though, interestingly enough, some people manage to turn that into a negative. They somehow say, the guy's too cool. He's too composed.
Yeah. You know, there are moments when I have a twinge of that. There is something, you know, cool can become cold at some point or unfeeling, and there is Obama's so cool that there's a slightly eerie quality about him. I mean, it's almost unnatural. I think this is mostly a positive, but you can see that some voters are a little put off by it. this feeling that he somehow lacks passion or can't relate to them. Bill Clinton was very good at conveying this feeling of feeling your pain is the cliche. I feel your pain, and a true pal like Bill Clinton can convey that. Maybe half fake, but he sure conveys that feeling. Whereas Obama's is a slightly standoffish and somewhat also, this is a related point, a cockiness about him that can be off-putting.
Yeah. I have this sense that at least there were significant numbers of people that if you go back maybe to the point where Senator McCain became the nominee, a little bit before, a little bit after, there would have been people who would, maybe even some people who would identify as Democrats, who would say something like, well, my preference, of course, would be for the Democratic candidate. But they might say something like, it's not going to, if John McCain becomes president of the United States, it's not going to be the end of the world. At some point, though, I think for a lot of people, that started to change. And they got to the point where they said, you know, really, I just can't, I could not feel good about voting for him. I could not feel good about him being the president. Was there some particular point, do you think, that for people who maybe were a little undecided, or at least would say that their assessment of Senator McCain was basically positive, was there some point where you think there was a significant shift?
Yes, I think there were a couple of points. They didn't happen overnight, but one, of course, was the selection of Governor Palin. It seemed at first to be an inspired choice because she was a maverick, but then it made people a little uneasy, and it made them wonder about McCain's judgment that he would pick somebody so untried, so untested, so seemingly unready. So that's one thing. I think another point when people just became nervous about McCain's steadiness is when the economy, or rather the banking system, really went to hell in October. You may recall on the eve of the first debate, all of a sudden there was a sense of real panic in the Bush administration and in the and Federal Reserve and Treasury and so forth. They said, oh my gosh, we are on the verge of our financial system going down and we got to bail it out. Well, McCain made a big show of rushing back to Washington to deal with it. But there was something very kind of clumsy and ham-handed because Washington didn't want him to rush back. He's not all that popular among Republicans. And so he looked sort of like he was kind of flailing around, and I think that made people nervous. And at the very same moment comes the first debate, and McCain wasn't all that steady in that debate. You know, it's so important, the image you project right off the bat, and Obama was Mr. Cool, and quote, presidential. And McCain was kind of edgier and tighter and tenser and angrier. And I think that made some of those independents that you're talking about who are thinking about voting for McCain, I think it made them nervous.
You know, I think that I'm sure looking back, if people are going to point to mistakes that had been made in the campaign, now looking back, they would say that the selection of Sarah Palin as the running mate was a big mistake, even though, as you say, there seemed to be this initial burst of excitement right after it was announced. It seemed that after a while, people began to voice some doubts. I think even some Republicans said, you know, this was not a good idea. The thing that I recall reading about this choice was that it sounded, again, from the stories that I read, as if Senator McCain actually didn't have that much to do with it, or at least that he hadn't, it wasn't the case that he had sat down and spent hours and hours and hours getting to know Sarah Palin and talking to her and trying to decide, you know, who she was. There seemed to be, in my mind, I think a lot of people's minds, this question, well, who made this decision and how was it made?
Sort of an impulse buy and a bit chaotic. If you go back and reconstruct, as we do in this book, what was happening at the time, some people in the McCain camp said, let's take the safe choice. Let's do Governor Pawlenty of Minnesota, who's a solid guy and safe. And McCain was pushing for his buddy Joe Lieberman, who was his close personal friend. McCain is a very kind of, he's a guy's guy, and he and Lieberman were just buddies, but McCain's aides say, no, you can't have Lieberman because half the Republican convention will walk out. Lieberman's pro-choice. You can't do that to your own party. So there's a stalemate right there. And this is late in the game when McCain is still pushing for his buddy Lieberman and his aides are pushing back saying you can't do that. So really late in the game, although there had been some talk about Governor Palin, late in the game, bang, she pops in. She has the attention of Steve Schmidt, who's the campaign manager, who's partial to her as kind of a throw-long, radical, maverick choice. And this is where McCain comes in. She appeals to McCain's rebellious instincts. You know, let's try something. Let's try something that's really different, really a little bit off the wall. Let's surprise him. I mean, this is very much one thing that people like about McCain, that he is surprising, and also makes people nervous about McCain, that, again, he is surprising. And so it was, as I say, sort of an impulse buy. There was, he barely had talked to her. He talked to her, I think, once on the phone for like 5 minutes at the Alaska State Fair a few months before. Then he got her on the phone and talked to her a little bit more. But he really barely knew her. He was choosing more the idea of her than her.
Yeah, I do seem to recall at least some reporting that said that as you say, he wanted Joe Lieberman, but then in fact, virtually right up to the point where they announced Sarah Palin, he was still holding out for Lieberman.
He was. I mean, as late as, let me see, Palin was announced on a Friday. I think as late as Wednesday night, McCain was still talking about Lieberman, which shows you how chaotic and last minute the whole thing was, again, in contrast to Obama, where it was a much more methodical decision-making process.
Yeah. Our guest this morning is Evan Thomas. He's editor-at-large for Newsweek. He's written more than 100 cover stories. He's also written a biography of Robert Kennedy and is now the author of a book that pulls together the reporting efforts of a number of people at Newsweek who covered the 2008 presidential campaign. The book is out now. It's titled A Long Time Coming, and it's published by Public Affairs Books. Questions are certainly welcome. We have a couple of people who are ready to go, and others are welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. First up, Champagne, and that's line one. Hello.
Hello. First, I was going to ask you, and this can be a yes or no, do you believe Governor Palin was a net positive or a net negative to Senator McCain's attempt at winning the presidency?
But polls strongly suggest a negative. Initially a positive, but then definitely a negative.
Secondly, what effect do you think McCain's and Palin's, what I would consider, the palling around with terrorists, Bill Ayers, who is the real Obama, is he a Muslim, is he an Arab, that type of what I guess we would call negative campaigning, what effect did that have on independents and, say, some of your suburban whites, especially suburban white females?
Yeah, that's an important point, and I should have mentioned it earlier on things that made people, independents, uncomfortable about McCain. It's a little confusing because McCain, I would say, sort of went halfway down the low road. He didn't go all the way. But he was getting pushed by his own staff to go further. To his credit, McCain refused in the fall to bring up Reverend Wright and to get into race. He really wanted to stay away from that. There were people inside his own campaign pushing him to bring up Reverend Wright. Independent groups wanted to do it, but McCain did not. And I think in retrospect, he deserves some credit for that because there was a lot of concern that the Republicans were going to take the low road here. This is a fairly well-traveled path. In 1988, you may recall George Bush running against Dukakis, used that Willie Horton ad, basically playing on the fears of voters. And there was a concern that McCain would do that, and they did some of it. Palin, for instance, brought up Ayers. You were mentioning Ayers. That was unrehearsed. There was a plan to bring Ayers up, but they were going to do it more slowly and methodically. And Palin brought Ayers up out of the blue, and partly because she was irritated at her handlers from the McCain campaign. By then, she was sick of her handlers, and she's kind of a free spirit, and she was getting some response out there on the stump by throwing out red meat, like that line about Obama palling around with terrorists, I think the line was, in reference to Ayers. And Palin was sort of revving up crowds doing this, and yes, she did rev up some crowds, but it had a off-putting effect on those independent voters that we were talking about earlier. And indeed, even within McCain's own campaign, they thought that she jumped the gun doing that and were made uncomfortable by it.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. I'm wondering, from what you know about how people in the Obama campaign thought about the controversy with Reverend Wright, I think some people would have made the argument that it was unfortunate that he took the opportunity to grab a little bit of the spotlight at Mr. Obama's expense. And I would have thought that some people in the campaign actually would have been fairly angry about that.
I'm sorry, in which campaign?
Oh, I'm sorry, within the Obama campaign.
Yeah, within the Obama campaign.
Yeah.
Well, sure. I mean, there was, I think, one of the most significant moments of the entire campaign came when those YouTube videos mm-hmm. of Reverend Wright popped up in March or April. I forget what it was. And this is a rare screw-up by the Obama campaign. Obama himself and David Axelrod is chief campaign consultant, had said to their staff, go through those videotapes and find out what there is on Wright and let's deal with it. Somebody dropped the ball, didn't do it, bam, up come these YouTube things that make very, very embarrassing to the Obama camp, and there's a big media firestorm about it. And the Obama campaign, you know, Axelrod and the others, they just want it to go away. They don't want to have to deal with it. This is a subtle but important point. The Obama campaign did not want to talk about race, period, because if they did, it inevitably would bring to the fore Obama's own race. They did not want it to be a campaign about race, because if it was, Obama would be identified by his race, and that was going to hurt him. So just stay away from race. So here comes Reverend Wright, and the campaign is going, oh, man, I wish this would just go away. Obama alone, and this is very important to me, Obama alone, not with his aides, approval. In fact, they're resistant to it. Obama says, no. I got to deal with this. I got to give a speech. I have to talk about this issue. I can't just kick it down the road. He faces up to it. He writes that speech basically alone. It's a really good speech. It goes a long way to dealing with a very difficult for Americans to discuss issue. And it effectively didn't make the right thing go away, but it diffused it. It was a both politically shrewd move by Obama, and I think showed some moral courage.
Let's talk with someone else. Geneva, Illinois, our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Great topic. You know, this book that you're writing in, or that you wrote in all this conversation about who said what, or he said, she said stuff. But I firmly believe it came down to one thing, is the economy. I don't even think the war had anything to do with it. I think the economy was perfect timing for a major upset with the Republicans. I'm a former Republican, and I'm ashamed to say that I was, because the Republican Party in the last 8 years had a chance to change things, and they didn't. And John, and a good example of what I'm talking about is John McCain. Yeah, he's rebellious. He's an old geezer. He knows what he's talking about. He tried to change things for the good of the nation and go against his party. And every time that he tried that, the old party venue comes up again, and he got shut down. My question, though, would be, you know, do you think that there's ever going to be a change of new blood in the Republican Party that will change like the maverick John McCain is?
Yeah, I agree with you that the economy was overwhelmingly important. In fact, although I just wrote a whole book about it, you could say the election was decided by the economy, that the American people were just not going to vote for a Republican when the economy was doing so badly. There's a view that no matter what McCain did, no matter how good a campaign he ran, he was going to lose just because people just weren't going to vote for a Republican when the economy was crashing in October. So I agree with that. Now, to your question of can the Republicans come up with somebody? They need to go back to the drawing board. I mean, the temptation for the true blue Republicans is to go run a populist appeal. Palin did some of that, where you try to get people scared, really, the kind of conservatism, populism, where you play to the fears of people, try to stir up particularly low-income, less well-educated voters. That only goes so far. In American politics, I guess I'm glad to say that those kind of fear tactics, you know, usually don't work. by themselves. Bush had success with Willie Horton in 88, and Richard Nixon had success with his so-called Southern strategy in 68. But in those cases, that was only just part of the package. Bush and Nixon had much bigger tents. That included not just sort of angry white males or those voters, but also moderates and independents. The Republican, you know, tent was big enough to accommodate independents and moderates as well as angry populists. So there's a long way of saying I don't think the Republicans are going to get back to 51% to a majority vote unless they extend their core group from populists who are mad at Washington and the elites and all that to a bigger tent to get in some of those moderates and independents as well. And the Republicans have to figure out how to do that. They've done it before. They'll probably be able to do it again. But right now, they're in disarray.
All right. Again, I want to thank the caller. I have somebody else who's been waiting for a bit here. I want to try to get to them, and that's Decatur, line number two. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Mm-hmm. The way I see it, McCain had to run to the center. And so he chose Palin, his staff chose. They chose Palin because they needed somebody to tie down the right, keep the religious right energized, and keep those people voting, and so he could run to the middle. Period. Pure and simple. Fine.
I don't think it was quite that neat. I mean, at least in our reporting, it was much more kind of fly by the seat of the pants McCain move. It wasn't so well thought out as that. There may be advisors who looked at it that way, but it was more, hey, let's take a gamble here. We're behind. Here's this interesting gal up there in Alaska, fresh, interesting, kind of like me, a maverick like me. And I think that had more to do with it than any kind of calculation about tying down the right. I mean, they already had the right. Yes, there was an issue about turning out the right, but I think a colder view of this, or I guess you're suggesting this, a colder-eyed view would say, no, what you really got to worry about is the center.
Other questions, welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. The guest this morning, Newsweek editor-at-large Evan Thomas, and he is the author of the book that brings together a lot of reporting that different people working for Newsweek have done on the 2008 campaign. The title, A Long Time Coming, and the book's published by Public Affairs. It's out now. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. One of the things, going back to the primary, one of the things that we know is that Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, both of them individually, managed to raise a stunning amount of money. In fact, they were raising so much money that they decided to forego the public financing because that would have restricted the amount of money that they could raise and spend. A lot of people, I think, at that point said, well, that means that public financing of presidential campaigns are over. No one's going to do it anymore, not if they can raise that much money, that much private money. I'm thinking of the difference now between the Obama campaigns and the McCain campaigns. How much difference did money make, or did the amount of money that they had to spend on ads and campaign offices and so forth, did that not make that much difference?
In the end, I don't think money made a huge difference. I think both campaigns had enough money. There are little differences that are interesting. One of them would be this. It's perceived that McCain ran a negative campaign, whereas Obama ran a positive campaign. In fact, Obama ran just as many minutes of negative ads as McCain did. The difference was that Obama was so rich, he also, in addition to that, ran a whole bunch of positive ads. So the overall effect was that that Obama was running a more positive campaign than McCain. Now, that's kind of interesting. Political scientists can sort of look at that and scratch their heads. Did it have a big impact on the outcome? No, I don't think so. I think both campaigns had plenty of money.
Going back to asking a similar kind of question to that asked at the beginning, where I was asking about the personality of the candidates and their campaigns. If I ask that same kind of question about the Clinton campaign, about Hillary Clinton's campaign, going back to the primary period, and how you would characterize it, how would you do that?
Disappointing. I mean, obviously for Hillary's followers, it was a really badly run campaign, and it raises real questions about her judgment and about her. She there's a tendency in the Clinton world to think that you're surrounded by enemies at all time, to go to the mattresses, as they say in books about the mafia, to just go to war with everybody around you. And this was this first started this whole idea of the war room. You run a campaign out of a war room, and you hit back right away. You never let a news cycle go a minute without responding to your enemies. And it was an effective thing in 1992. But I think the Clintons over time overdid it. And Hillary was particularly vulnerable to this idea that you really have to lash out at your enemies. And I think that she ran a campaign that was really just too hot and had a kind of an edge of anger to it. And this is important, she did a very poor job of refereeing the disputes within her own campaign. Since she thinks conflict is the normal order of things, she permitted way too much conflict within her own campaign structure and had aides. We describe these morning meetings where I think there were six or seven people sitting around the table. Every single one of those people, each one, knew that there was somebody at that table who tried to get them fired, or that they were trying to get fired themselves. That does not create a happy family and the kind of unity and coherence you have to run for president.
How much influence did the former president, Bill Clinton, have in his wife's campaign?
Too much. He's obviously a brilliant politician at so many levels, but he was a subversive force in her campaign. Psychologists can have fun with this about whether she kind of unconsciously tried to sabotage his own wife. I don't have a medical degree, so I really can't comment on that. But it's sort of a fun theory. Regardless of the psychology, he made a hash of things at the critical moment. You may recall that she lost Iowa, and then she wins in New Hampshire, and she wins in Nevada, and she's got a little comeback going when they go to South Carolina. But then Bill Clinton goes down there and makes just a mess of things by comparing Obama to Jesse Jackson, with the insinuation, or at least it was read this way, the insinuation that Obama was a, as they say in politics, a race man, that he was running for the black vote as Jesse Jackson had done before him. That drove the political elites in the Democratic Party nuts that Clinton would play, as they say, to use an unattractive phrase, play the race card that way. And it really caused a lot of bad blood and disaffection from the Clintons. And, I think history shows that that ex-President Clinton did, in the end, guaranteed that his own wife would not become another President Clinton.
Given that, did it surprise you that Mr. Obama chose Hillary Clinton to be Secretary of State?
Well, as Obama said, he was reading that Doris Kearns Goodwin book, Team of Rivals, and he believes in a big tent and this whole idea of bringing aboard your rivals. It's a symbolic thing, partly, to show voters that, I'm a big guy and I can handle different opinions and I can bring in my rivals. And it worked for Lincoln, who famously brought in Seward as the Secretary of State, even though they were bitter enemies and actually became friends during the course of the Civil War. That I have this kind of largeness of spirit, Obama's trying to tell voters, and I welcome Mrs. Clinton because, for she may have been my political opponent, she's well known around the world. She has a lot of experience. She's popular in Europe. She can bring something to the table.
We talked, it's sort of hard to believe, you all did a book like this on the 2004 race, and we talked about that. And one of the things that stands out in my mind, and we talked about it, was this meeting that you had after the election with John Kerry, where he comes off as someone who was really wounded by the experience and disappointed, as you might expect, but also someone who was a little bit mystified by his loss.
Yeah.
That he couldn't quite, It was sort of like, well, why don't people like me? He took it very personally.
Yeah.
And so I'm thinking, well, what sort of opportunities you have had, if you have had or other people have had, to actually have a similar kind of post-mortem conversation with John McCain?
I have not. There have been some sightings and reports. I was glad to hear that, although our book is pretty critical of him in places, that he thought it was a fair account or a good account of what had actually happened. That came to me secondhand. I didn't hear that firsthand from him. He's surfacing these days, I noticed. You know, he kind of went to Grant for a while and would wave off reporters. He'd be walking along and he'd say, "Not now, not now," and reporters approached him as he walked between the Capitol and his office. But he's now emerging, and he's emerging, interestingly, as a maverick Republican who wants to be Obama's wingman in the Senate. He wants to help his opponent. This is very McCain-esque, and I think this is the appealing sign of John McCain. John McCain has extraordinary grace that is hard for us normal people to understand, that people who have not been prisoners of war for 5.5 years. McCain had to do the impossible. He had to find a way to forgive his captors in Vietnam, the people who tortured him, and he has a kind of grace and transcendence rooted, I guess, in religion. I mean, there's certainly some stories to that effect. That he just makes him a remarkable guy, and he's flawed like the rest of us, but he does have this forgiveness, and I think he's shown it now, and he wants to. I thought it was really interesting that he has gone on the Senate Health Committee as the ranking minority guy, I understand, to help Obama get health care reform through. That would be a great act of bipartisanship, nonpartisanship, and really befitting his character.
Yeah. One thing I thought was really interesting, again, I guess this is one of those moments that you might say was Obama-esque, to hear about the fact that Mr. Obama, he had a dinner for John McCain. He had a dinner for the guy that he beat. And you sort of, you know, you think about President Bush, and I don't want to get into a lot of stuff about President Bush, but you think, President Bush didn't have a dinner for John Kerry, and it's kind of hard to imagine that he would have. And yet somehow this seems really in keeping on a, you know, you could say that this was genuine, you could say that this was calculated, and maybe it's both, but that seems to be really in keeping with the kind of guy that Obama seems to be.
Right. Well, I think it's just, you put your finger on it, it's both. It's a smart move politically, and I think it is sort of the way he is. I think there is Obama's an interesting guy. He has an ability to step away. He's self-contained. He's not, as my colleague Charles Krauthammer noted, he's not needy. You know, most politicians are needy as hell. That's one thing that motivates them to run. Bill Clinton, famously great politician, needed the love. Well, give me the love. Give me the love. Just wanted that public attention. You could see him soaking it up and needing it. And Obama's different. And as we were saying earlier, that can make him seem maybe a little too cool, a little too remote and detached, a little too attached. But it is it's a valuable thing to and gives you a kind of integrity and an independence and an ability to do things like having dinner with the person who was trying to undo you for the last 6 months, have dinner with your sworn political foe, John McCain.
We have a caller here to talk with in Champaign, line one. We'll go right there. Hello.
Yes, I'm just curious your view on one particular issue. Electoral practices, as we all know, the Republicans have used since the 2000 election and also to some extent in the 2004 election, state governments with which they were allied, the Republican governors of Ohio and Florida and so on. And as we all know, over the past few years, the state governments around the country have shifted in a Democratic direction, generally speaking. And I'm just wondering to what extent this contributed to Obama's election. Obama, of course, had a tremendous lead, but you know, if you recall, in 2004, there were great debates over Ken Blackwell's role and so forth, and we all know about Florida's issue in 2000. Did this shift in state governments contribute to this on some level, that they couldn't, quote-unquote, steal the election potentially this time around? And secondly, will Obama try to nationalize electoral practices? I mean, what I've never understood is the fact that I can go to my ATM and it works, but I can't go vote and know that my vote will be counted, and we still don't have a senator from Minnesota.
Yeah. I don't. Well, a couple things. One is I'm not an expert on the nitty-gritty of state politics enough to really give you an informed judgment about that. I am not a conspiracy theorist. I don't really like conspiracy theories, so I don't really buy the idea of state governors stealing elections. I just don't think that.
But perhaps influence the
Well, influence.
Access to.
Yeah, maybe so. I don't know enough to make a really informed judgment. My instincts tell me that that wasn't decisive. I mean, it may have been. There are a lot of factors here.
Yeah.
And it may have been a factor, but I don't. I just doubt that it was a decisive factor.
And you don't think that Obama will try to
Fix the voting system? Mm-hmm. You know, he's got so much to do. You know, they did. After it was so messed up in 2000, they did try to change it, and a lot of states went to automated voting. They couldn't get, state government is part of the problem of our federal system. Every state government does things a little differently. And
Right. They hired Diebold, right? So that was
and it didn't. And these machines didn't work. I mean, I know that there are scholars. Remember, there's a group at Princeton that found out you could hack into all these systems,
right?
It was pretty scary. The idea that you really could, clever hacker could change the outcomes. I don't think that happened this time, but the potential is there. You wish that there was an overall national IT approach to this, but look, the FBI spent years trying to get an IT system that worked and kept failing at it. I bet you that we're about to go through something like this about healthcare. You know, we're about to spend billions on an IT system for our healthcare system. I will be amazed if they are able to do something that's coherent and really works. Because once you get into secrecy and privacy issues, which is why the FBI couldn't do it, but healthcare's got similar issues or in the same general realm, IT solutions are a problem. Once you're dealing with security, it just gets, the whole thing gets harder to do. And for some reason, and I'm not an IT expert, it's just so hard to do that it doesn't get done right.
But the one thing that's interesting is on the financial end of things, they need to learn from the banks, apparently, because they've obviously done something right, because the system does work in that regard.
I mean, the private sector, I mean, to make a gross overgeneralization here, the private sector generally does stuff better or more efficiently than the private sector. Now, there is a gray area in between when the public sector contracts out to the private sector, but for reasons I don't quite understand, that doesn't seem to work either. This contracting out to private groups, as I think the FBI did with IBM and others, somehow doesn't produce a system that works. Is there some flaw with the contracting a system? Is there some lack of competition? I don't quite grasp why this is, but I am under the strong impression that when the private marketplace does it, it just seems to work more efficiently than when the public hand is involved.
Yeah. Got about 10 minutes left. I have some other callers. I want to thank the last caller. Again, introduce our guest, Evan Thomas. He's editor-at-large for Newsweek, written more than 100 cover stories. He's authored a biography of Robert Kennedy and a number of other books, and he is the author of a book that brings together reporting of a number of people at Newsweek. It's on the 2008 campaign. The title is A Long Time Coming, and it's published by Public Affairs Books. Next, we'll talk with someone here where we are in Champaign County, line 2. Hello.
Hi. I will get back to my motivation for calling, which is about the discussion inside the Obama campaign about what's really going to happen in Iraq with withdrawal of which troops and which independent contractors, et cetera, and what who will be redesignated. But in the last few minutes, I have to respond to the truism about how efficient private enterprises right now is kind of, it's hard to imagine that we're going to hold up the banks up as some kind of paragon.
Oh, that's a good point.
Of efficiency.
Yeah, you got me there.
They're bollocked up beyond belief at this point.
Although, you know, there's a public piece of that, too. That was an unfortunate case of
Glass-Steagall and all that stuff, and the Enronization of
obviously the private sector, the banks, and the banking system has made a mess of things.
Yeah, well, it's a sort of a state capture phenomena where the banks have had control of the public enterprise, too, and that's maybe, and then they attack the public enterprise. But anyway, the other point I'd like to make is that I think you should examine the quality of the electoral system. It's easy to be dismissed as a conspiracist, but when an IT expert for Karl Rove dies in a plane crash several days before he's supposed to give some kind of testimony, it kind of feeds the fodder of that, and you probably don't even know that happened. But the point I wanted to make about Iraq and the equivocation about withdrawal is that the campaign all along said they were going to withdraw combat troops, and that means that trainers and force protection up to 55,000 troops could still remain. I've heard a figure as high as 70,000. And now they're talking about redesignation of combat troops so that they can fulfill their promise without really leaving. It's Kafkaesque. I just wanted to know if your people actually heard any kind of discussion about that kind of thing inside contemporaneously, because, you know, the front was that it's a withdrawal, and I agree that economics trumps in the election, but as far as the base and the people that really went out to work for Obama, these people are expecting a break with occupation of Iraq, and I'm not confident they're going to get it unless there's a further pressure to actually fulfill it. I mean, the equivocation about private contractors, I mean, if we were to withdraw all of the combat troops but then leave military contractors, 35,000 or whatever, however many there really are under arms, it wouldn't be much of a solution either. There's even a further complication. If there's a lot of redesignation of military troops as not being combat, then they are subject to Iraqi law under the provisions of the SOFA agreement, which Odierno isn't going to be happy with. And I don't know.
I saw on the paper today that the U.S. ambassador to Iraq said the situation is fragile, meaning don't go too quickly. I'm sure Obama's going to hear that. The Pentagon does sometimes do creative things with designations and numbers. I wouldn't be so sure, for instance, that the number of 30,000 in Afghanistan is the correct number. I suspect it's actually higher once you look at who's there. My own guess is that Obama's not going to rush out of Iraq. We're going to be there for a long time. I have no idea what the numbers are going to be, but they're not going to be insignificant.
We have another caller. Let's go to Oakwood, line number 4. Hello.
Hi there. How are you?
Good.
Good. Just going back to what you were talking about with Obama and the McCain dinner earlier, that aspect of his character, it just seems like I was watching the Dreams of Obama on Frontline the other night, and that just seems to be a part of his character where he can go ahead and relate to people, not so much ideologies as the people and their ideas that they have, like he said in his inaugural address, you know, what works in government, not so much big or small. And this is, you know, this is a guy who went ahead and became, what, president of the Harvard Law Review, and spoke about his ability to walk the razor's edge between, you know, opposing factions and, you know, find the common ground that was needed. And it just seems like this is something that's going to hold him in good stead to come here.
I think it's vital. I mean, I think it could be the most important quality he has, because he's going to have to walk a lot of razor's edges as the months go on. It's one thing to get a stimulus package through Congress. Congress likes to spend money, but the second half of that equation is what do we do about entitlements, about Social Security and Medicare and all those looming costs that are going to leave our children penniless if we don't fix it. Obama has clearly stated that he's not going to kick that can down the road anymore. Other presidents have done that. He's going to deal with it. He's going to have a heck of a time bringing together different opposing forces to get the votes to cut Social Security or raise taxes to pay for it, to reform the health care system in such a way that it cuts back on Medicare. Those are going to be really tough votes, and he's going to have to convince diametrically opposed interests that he represents their interests at heart.
Well, it just seems like he seems to be the best chance we've had in a while for this to happen.
Yeah, I think that's true.
All right.
Okay.
Well,
thank you.
Thank you. Certainly no one knows what's going to be happening 4 years from now, so talking about that and then talking about another 4 years from that is engaging in pretty wild speculation. But so if we assume that President Obama stands for re-election, that then the next time another Democrat could come up, it's some ways down the road. But having said all that, I'm thinking about Hillary Clinton. Do you think that she would run again? Or?
Well, she's a tank, you know. I mean, she's a pretty indestructible gal. So anything is possible. And politics is the entire life and existence of the Clinton family. That's the basis of their marriage. So, sure, anything is possible. They have a lot of loyalists. But, boy, that's a long way away. And she's got a big job right now, and it's the kind of job that could make her or bring her down, depending on what happens in the Middle East, for instance, and what happens with inside this country. So it's speculative. I don't think that Mrs. Clinton is going to kind of go gently into the night, or her husband. But I just can't look at my crystal ball and see that far.
Yeah. Do you have any sense of what she went through as she was thinking about whether or not that she would take the job of Secretary of State?
I think she thought about it for about a nanosecond.
That much, huh? So I guess the obvious calculation would be, you know, where can you have the greater influence and where will you have the greater profile as senator from the state of New York or as Secretary of State of the United States? So maybe that was kind of a no-brainer.
Yeah, I know. I my understanding is that she didn't think about it all that hard. For one thing, she didn't have much seniority in the Senate, and she was not going to be – she wanted to run health care, and she was not going to. Teddy Kennedy's going to take that. And, you know, so I don't think her prospects were all that great. In the Senate, she can make a bigger splash as Secretary of State.
Yeah. One of the questions that you posed right up front, and again, this is maybe a little speculative, but there are obvious ways in which Barack Obama's election was and is historic. But then if you ask this question, do you think that he and his campaign have changed American politics in some large and permanent way? Do you, in fact, think that has happened?
Well, here's what I want to believe, is that we are – Obama does not like the word post-racial because he thinks that's utopian. That doesn't really – you're never post-racial because that's just not the way people are. But I think we made a pretty important step in that direction in getting past this terrible thing that's divided our country for so long. I was, as many, many people were, enormously moved on Inauguration Day, not by his speech, which I thought was sort of unmemorable, but by the whole scene, by the crowds, by the mixed-race crowds, by the cheerfulness of them, by Aretha Franklin singing My Country, 'Tis of Thee. It just was an unbelievable message to the world that confounds our enemies. You know, the world likes to think that America is this horribly racially divided, wicked place. And here we elect a black guy whose middle name is Hussein, and we do it in such a calm and uplifting way. It sends the most wonderful message to the rest of the world, and I hope we live up to our own image.
Well, clearly for African-Americans, the fact that Barack Obama is a person of color has huge significance, and I'm sure enters into their feelings about him. It seems to be the case. I'm sure that we can go out and if we polled white voters who voted for him, that they would say, well, I didn't vote for him because he was black. I voted for him because I thought he was the best guy for the job, that something about him struck me. And I'd say, OK, this is the guy that I'm going to go with. And that they would say race didn't exactly enter into it. I mean, could it actually be?
No, I think there's actually some polling data that suggests that race did enter into it.
Really?
White voters, yeah.
Really? So
the whole thing that we've just been talking about, the transcendence of electing a black man, I think some white voters were affected by it. I think there's polling data that suggests some white voters were affected by that.
That they actually, that somehow the fact that he was black entered into their
decisions. Yeah, I mean, let's show the world that we can elect a black man. Just the point I was making. Andrew Sullivan wrote a famous piece about this in the Atlantic Monthly about the message that it sends to the rest of the world. I think certainly amongst the liberal elites in the East, people I know, no question that Obama's, I'm talking about white people now, Obama's race was a factor in them voting for him.
Yeah. One thing I thought was interesting just recently on National Public Radio, they did an interview with Newt Gingrich, and one of the things that he said was that he thought that the transition was maybe the most organized, and again, maybe that, you know, says something about him and his people, that no incoming administration had ever been so together and had so much in place in the lead up, in the transition. And in fact, he says he thinks from now on that it's going to be more like that, so that indeed, right on the first day, as much as you can be ready to go, you're ready to go.
Well, that's literally true, of course, just if you measure it by number of appointments and so forth. Obama had a special incentive because the economy is going to the dogs very fast, and so he had to have things in place. And the pace of change in the world generally, and also I think he's sending the message that part of this nonpartisan, postpartisan idea is that you don't have to lurch from one extreme to the other and just start from scratch. You want to do this seamlessly. And ex-President Bush deserves a lot of credit for this. He was gracious. I think he really worked with Obama to make sure that there was a good handoff. I think President Bush remembered that one reason why 9/11 happened was that there was a bad handoff between the Clinton administration and the Bush administration on national security. They weren't paying enough attention to terror. And I think that Bush was determined that that not happen. Obama was as well. And I think there was a real effort to have a seamless transition.
Yeah. I suspect one of the things that might happen, and it could turn out to be wrong, but I suspect that maybe for some very liberal Democrats, they're going to turn out to be a little disappointed with Mr. Obama because he's not going to be as liberal as they would like.
For sure. It's already happened.
And which also sort of makes me wonder, you know, what kind of struggles he's going to have with his own party and Democrats in Congress to get them to do what he would like them to do.
Well, we'll see. I mean, they're not going to like it when he cuts Social Security and cuts Medicare. He's going to have a rebellion on his left. He's obviously signaled he's going slow on this check card law that the unions want to make it easier to organize for labor activity. Obama said that he's for it, but he's not exactly rushing to do it. And I think there's going to be some resentment about that. He's going to be attacked from the left and the right, which is about where he ought to be.
Yeah. If you want to read more about the 2008 campaign, look for the book we mentioned a couple times, A Long Time Coming. The subtitle is The Inspiring Combative 2008 Campaign and the Historic Election of Barack Obama. Brings together the reporting efforts of a number of people at Newsweek, including our guest this morning, Evan Thomas. He's editor at large. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thanks, David.